Hi, everybody. My name is Don Norman, and I'm an alcoholic. And first of all, I want to thank the committee from Dallas for having me back here again. I was here 11 years ago, and now they asked me back. I thought, that really is nice, you know, for me to tell this tired story again, you know. And they decorated me. You see, I have decorations on and everything. And how that... They didn't give me any lipstick. I don't know what's wrong with them. But anyway, I'm going to tell you what happened to me, you know, in this Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and before I got here. The biggest thing that I think that really wrecked me more than anything was when I found out that I wasn't a girl. You know, that was... traumatic, you know. It was really like I was wrecked, you know, and everything. And you know, you have to make the most of a bad situation, you know. So I've tried hard to be butch. And sometimes I make it, sometimes I don't. Anyway, I grew up in Los Angeles. I was born in L.A., actually in Silver Lake, and on the thing it says West Hollywood, so I have to clarify right away that I'm not from West Hollywood, yet I am from Hollywood, and that's a big difference. about 2 miles, that's all. Santa Monica Boulevard is this big street that runs through Los Angeles, and it starts downtown, and downtown is like Chinatown, and then it's like, you know, Alvera Street, which is the oldest part of L.A., and then it keeps going boogie, 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 and then pretty soon you get to Silver Lake, and Silver Lake is like fabulous. It's just like really fabulous. It's a big gay community in Silver Lake. That's where I was born, Silver Lake, and everything. And we were the first queens there, me and my brother. Anyway, and then it keeps going. It goes through Hollywood, and, you know, that's where everything is happening, all kind of things, people leaning off of the street and posing and boys and everything, you know. And then it goes through Hollywood, and we pass by, you know, all the gay and lesbian places, and then you go to West Hollywood, and that's where Boys Town is. And so this whole street is this fabulous street, and I live one block from it, and it's just the best in the world. I love it there. I love Los Angeles. I'm so happy I was born there. It's the best thing what happened. I'm going to tell you, this is to be offensive at all, but on June the 19th, long ago, they freed the slaves, and here in Texas... And I have a letter from my great-grandfather that describes what happened that day. And he was from Texas. And they came from Texas and went to Los Angeles. So my whole family's from Texas. So when I get down here, I feel very comfortable because everybody's polite. They say, yes, ma'am, and how are you? Everybody speaks to you and everything. In Los Angeles, they won't speak. They're afraid you're going to shoot them or something, you know? Anyway. I come from this Baptist family, and I was, you know, a little kid, and I was there in the house, and my mother and father, you know, raised us to be polite and do things and go to church. You know, I had to go to church all the time, and you went on Sunday, you went on Wednesday, you had BYPU, you had choir rehearsal, and then you had to go to school and all those things, and you always had grown-ups that were... You had to mind. I don't know if you all understand, but you had to mind everybody, you know, and anybody that said anything, you had to mind. Well, I have this kind of personality that does not want to mind anybody. I don't want to mind nobody. But because they'll beat you, you know, when you're little. I'll put you behind, you know, and anybody, you know, anybody can say you did something, you're in trouble. So it was like, boy, I can't wait till I get big enough to do what I want to do. That gives you a clue to my personality. I wanted to do what I wanted to do when I was little, and I did not want to cooperate for some reason. I don't know what it was. It's the contrariness about me, you know? And so there I was, growing up, trying to, you know, act nice. They beat your ass for this and beat your ass for that and, you know, and slap the snot out of you. I don't know if your parents would do that. They'd say, I'll slap the snot out of you. I'll be all over you like white on rice, you know? And you know, you're just, boy, I can't wait till I get big enough. Now, the grown-ups around are doing what they want to do. They go to the bucket of blood, and they go to the dewdrop inn, and they go out, and they come home, and you hear them in the living room talking about, ooh, girl, we had a ball. We went over to the bucket of blood. We had a, ooh, girl. And y'all think, ooh, I wonder what they did at the bucket of blood, you know. God, whatever it was, I wanted to do it, you know. So I'm trying, laying dead to get going, but I had to go to school and do those things, and I didn't have a lot of trouble in school. I was one of those kids in school that had a lot of fun. I had a personality that was kind of cheerful. I always had that kind of personality, and so I had fun in school, and I played jacks and jump rope and tetherball and all those things. I liked those games. I was really good at jump rope, you know, and so there was never anything said in my family. I cannot recall one time in my family where anybody said anything about us acting like girls. Now, my brother's gay, too, by the way, but I was a little bit more outgoing, you know, and... So I can remember on Sundays that, you know, you had to dress up and go to church on Sunday, and you couldn't play in your Sunday clothes. You know, you had to take off your Sunday clothes before you could play. Well, we were down at my cousin's house, and we lived way up the street, you know, like several blocks up. And so I could wear Shirley's dress to play in. Can you imagine? Nobody said, no, Don's wearing Shirley's dress. That's it. And Shirley wore my pants, you see. I come from a really cool family. I got a bunch of lesbian cousins and everything. And so nobody said nothing. So I'm fine. You know, I'm going to school and everything. And you couldn't do anything to us because I had like 30 cousins. You know, if you have that many cousins, you can't do nothing. I remember this girl named Norma called me a sissy one time. She was, boy, was she in trouble. And she said, sissy, you know, and I went and told Janet and Doreen and Artie, these are my cousins, tall girls, big girls, lesbians, by the way. She called me a sissy. They went over there, and you know how they bump up to somebody and push her, hey, girl, what you call my cousin? She said, I didn't call him nothing. I said, yes, she did. She called me a sissy, beat her up. You know what I mean? So you see, I was well protected. You know, I felt just fine. And so I had fun in grammar school. And then I went on to junior high school. And I had a ball in junior high school. That was volleyball came out, you know. And I loved playing volleyball. I was really good at volleyball, you know. And I liked that. And I was participating in everything. And then, you know, the teachers, every teacher had my aunts and my father, you know, everything. So you had to kind of live up to this reputation. And I'd have teachers... Oh, Donald, your Aunt Martha never act like that, you know. And I was really sullen and insolent and uncooperative. They wrote that down, you know. That's the kind of student I am. And I could get A's. I was really clever. I had, actually, all it is I have this ability to remember whatever I read. And so I could read things, and that would be it. I'd read it, and that was it for the semester, and I could pass all the tests. But then I'd get used in work habits and cooperation because I was bad. You know, I'd talk blah, 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 in the class and make faces at the teacher and what have you. But, you know, I had fun. I just had fun. I was stealing, you know, go stealing things and steal things here. And it was just a big time. I had the best time in junior high school. Then I got to high school. That was the best of all. By this time, you know what, I'm a student body government, and I'm running track. The only reason I ran track, I can tell you guys this, but I can't tell it at street meetings, is my father was a Golden Gloves boxer, and he had this big dream that his sons were going to box, you know. So he bought these boxing gloves, you know, and he put them on us, and me and my brother, you can imagine. We did not want to box. Give them to Janet. And he wanted us to be, you know, play baseball and football, and we, those are contact sports. I don't know if you all know that, but, you know, a baseball can smash you in your face. And in football, they can knock you down in the dirt, and your pants get dirty, and you so I wouldn't play those things. I knew how, but I didn't like them, you know, and so I ran track. For the sake of my father, I ran track, and I could run fast like the wind, you know, and I run, and I'd win, and oh, he was so happy, you know, and everything, and I felt good, and I started smoking cigarettes, and the coach didn't want us smoking cigarettes, and I got a 3-year varsity letterman sweater, because it was, I wanted this sweater, because it was so sharp. I mean, this sweater was fashion. And so I had this sweater, and I got that, and the minute that was over, I started smoking cigarettes and everything. The coach said, don't do it, but we did it, and I was one of the kids in L.A. that was always integrating or, you know, representing, and I would represent Los Angeles at the United Nations. I remember going to the United Nations and representing there, and Donald is really something, and then I went to the capital, you know, Washington, D.C., and integrated the restaurants there as a student and went to the Capitol and saw the Supreme Court and did all this stuff. Donald is wonderful and everything. They thought that I was really going to be something, you know, and everything. And I'm plotting in my head this whole time. I'm thinking, I can't wait till I get big and I can get out there and I can do just what I want to do and nobody can't tell me nothing. And this was in my head. Baby, the minute that I got old enough, the minute school was over, the second that they said you walk across the stage, we had a bottle, baby. Hey, you know, and I remember how, it makes you, know how it goes down and goes all the way to your fingertips, you know, and everything, and boom, you know, you're wild. I thought, oh, yeah, I'm going to drink this shit the rest of my life. Honey, and I started ripping and running through the streets of Hollywood and Los Angeles, and I had my tight booty buster pants on, and honey, I was having a ball, and you know, your mother and father start looking at you, you know, and everything, and they're, what is wrong with you? And you just twist and turn. And you get to go to the gay bars, and I forged my ID, you know, like you. Back in those days, we had to have a selective service card, and I forged it, made me older, and I went to the gay bars. Oh, it was heaven. All crowded in, everybody's in there, groping people. Oh, it was dreadful, but it was fun, you know? And I'm just happy, you know, and everything. I'm drinking beer and everything, and running around. Back in those days, if you were in the bar, the police could come in and raid the bar. And they used to raid the bars all the time, and they'd get us for touching each other. If you touched somebody, it was considered lewd conduct. And they'd come in and get us, and we'd be run out the bar, and we had after hours, and everybody would go to people's houses, and we'd drink. And I remember always watching my drink. We'd drink and party, just the best time. And I'm young. You can bounce back. It's nothing to it, you know. You could drink, and it's no serious situation. I met this boy. Now, this boy, I don't remember his name. That's really cold. I don't remember his name. But he was fine. Oh, he was fine. Light brown skin with smoky gray eyes. And he said, let's join the Air Force as buddies, you know, and everything. And I thought he said, let's get married. So, you know. There I am, drunk. Now, drunk, I'm drunk, and I go down there to join the Air Force. You know, he signed up there. He was never there. I never saw him again. And there I am in the Air Force, you know. I swear to protect the country from enemies and foreign and domestic, blah, blah, blah. And I'm in, boom. And you get in there, and they tell you what to do all the time. All the time. There's always somebody yelling at you and telling you to make up the bed and shine shoes. Shine shoes. What do you think I am? I'm not no shoe shine boy. Oh, it was just a mess. Just a mess. I got in trouble in there all the time. I had never been around people who hadn't been around people from California, from L.A. Now, these people were from other places, and they would call us names. They would actually call us outright names, just say names. Oh, I would just beat their ass. Now, I was kind of butch, and I told you I was a tomboy. And because, like, I'd beat them up, you know, and so they would never give me a stripe. I'm in trouble all the time. I said, every time they call me a name like that, I'm going to beat them up. And they didn't bother me too much because you have a weapon. You know, they had put me in this thing, and I had this weapon. And so, you know, people don't mess with you too much when you have that. So anyway, I'm in the Air Force, in trouble all the time, and they made me a policeman. They decided I should be a policeman. Now, I'm from Los Angeles, California, and I have to tell you, the police in Los Angeles, California have a bad reputation with black people. Terrible, terrible reputation. They're fine now. They're much better now. They have changed a lot. You know, they even have lesbians and gay men on the police force. It's something now. But back then, they were mean, and I hated the police. I hated, and they made me a policeman. Oh, oh, how could they do this to me? You know, and so there I am, a policeman with a gun on my hip. And cute, they did give me cute shoes and a cute hat and everything. But they sent me to Alaska, and I to be a policeman. Now, I had never, ever seen snow in my life, you know. So I go up to Alaska, and I remember getting there, and it was like raining. It rained a lot, and they said when the snow gets down the mountain, it'll start snowing here. And I thought, okay, now, they did have a lot of liquor up there, cheap, 25 cents for a pitcher of beer, really cheap, so you could drink. Yeah, we're all drunk all the time. Then I remember they took our weapons away from us because people were playing. You know, they play that cowboy shit. You know, bam, bam, and then a couple of guys got killed, you know, and so they would take our weapons away at night. But at any rate, the snow started coming down, and I remember seeing it, you know, and I'm from L.A., and all I know is, like, I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. And, oh, it's so pretty, you know, and everything. And it falls, la, 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 and everything. And honey, it keeps snowing. And it snows some more, and it keeps snowing, and then blizzards happen, and then the snow and the ice make these bumps in the ground, and you slide on. Oh, and your nose freezes. It's bad, really bad. I hated it. I told him I have to go home. And they were kind of messing with me anyway, so I told them, you know, I have to go. And they said, you can't go. I said, oh, yes, I can. And so I got out on a homosexual discharge, and they marched me off that base with guns in my head, you know, and told me, they had the nerve to tell me, now I'm from Hollywood. They told me, you'll never make it in the world. You'll never have a job. I looked at them, they must be crazy, you know. Just let me get home. I got back home. I kissed the ground in Los Angeles. I was so happy to be there. I said, I never want to see snow as long as I live. And then I started running. Then I got my first grown-up job at the county hospital. It's this big hospital in Los Angeles. And I'm working there and drinking every night and running. I'm happy again. I'm home and doing what I want to do. My mother and father had a house in the back of their house. And so I lived back there, partied all the time, people in and out, all these tramps and fools, everybody. Oh, we're just having a good time. And my mother and father are looking at me going, I didn't care. I just kept doing what I was doing, and I'm drinking. And at the hospital, I worked in this office called the dispatch office, and all the pills that came through the hospital for the doctor's samples came through our office. And so I saw them. You know, there they are, and, you know, I could read, and I would read. I'd read, you know, do you suffer from insomnia and joint pains? And then, yes, and that. Do you have depression? And then, yes. So I'm taking these pills and drinking wine and partying all night long. And then you meet people who help you out. People are giving you pills. And I remember going to work. You go to work, and the nurses there would say, how do you feel? You know, and everything. And you tell them how you feel, and they give you a pill to counteract that feeling, you know. And so I'm taking pills, and I met these queens that were dangerous women, you know. And they were selling drugs, and they had bennies, and they came in kegs of bennies, 1,000 in a keg. And bennies are speed, and you take them. and you wake up and you talk fast. And you can drink a lot, and I'm drinking more and taking these pills, and then they start passing out Red Devils, they're sick and all, and these are pills that knock you out, you know? And so you have to take the pills that wake you up and drink this, and then you get too woke up and you take the pills that calm you down. It's a little balancing act there. And by this time, I had met this guy. Well, they smoked weed in my neighborhood, and so I just told Boogie one night, bring me some weed. This guy's name was Boogie, and he brought these joints over, and we smoked these joints, and I remember my eyelashes got long and glittery. I thought, I'm going to smoke this shit the rest of my life. I'm all happy, you know, no cares in the world. I'm about 22 years old, living it up. Not having too much trouble and everything. And as life goes on, things start happening. You know, more shit starts up. And I get captured by the police one night. As I'm just driving through Beverly Hills one day, and they get after me, and I keep driving. And I had seen too many movies, for one thing. And I thought that if I crossed the county line, you know, between... you probably saw The Streets of Laredo, too. And so... So I got across the line. They don't count, though. They put you in jail anyway. And so I went to jail for possession of a roach, a marijuana roach. And back in those days, it was a felony. And then I went to jail for this felony, and I thought, man, this is terrible. So I had to be more careful. I came out, and I started running. I didn't stop. You'd think I'd stop, but I didn't stop. I kept smoking weed and taking pills and drinking wine and beer and ripping and running and partying and having myself a good time and doing everything I was big enough to do. If anybody told me anything, you know what I'd say? Just kiss my ass. You know, I've gotten bold, and I could cuss too, you know, and I'm just vulgar and wrong. And then, you know, my mother and them, like I told you, they look at me and say, the older you get, the worse you get. And I'm right there with them. I could always be at home with my mother and father. And so anyway, I'm drinking more and more, and things are going a little bit jibbity-jibbity. And I met another guy who was from San Francisco, and we kind of had a thing going, and he was really a bad drunk. I mean, he was really a lush, you know? And so I gave him some pills. I said, you should straighten up, honey. And so we've formed this little thing, and we're doing this thing. And I remember he told me one day, he said, well, could you get some heroin? And I said, sure, I can get some heroin. I was right at the corner. And so I ran up to the corner and bought this heroin. I remember it was $2 a cap, and I got this heroin and came back, and we laid it out on the table, and we put a little white thing, you know, Queens, and we put a little white thing and cotton and alcohol and all these things, and we did it and wrapped our arms up, and I shot heroin in my arm, and I went like that. I said, ooh, I'm going to shoot this shit the rest of my life. Yeah. So now I'm in it. You know, I'm in this thing. I'm shooting heroin, smoking weed, and taking pills, and drinking wine, and ripping and running. I had to move to Venice. Remember June told about Venice? The reason you move to Venice is because your chances of going to jail go way down, because there's so many people there getting loaded that they can't capture everybody, you know? I lived down there, and by this time they started inventing all the different drugs like LSD and DMT and STP and all those drugs, initial drugs, and some of them were really bad, you know, and you would think you wouldn't take it, but I did it. I took them anyway. I remember smoking PCP, which is angel dust. I hated it. I hated it. I smoked it for 10 years. I couldn't stand it. So by this time, they had invented crystal methadrine, this methadrine up in San Francisco. And so I start shooting that, too. And I'm shooting methadrine wide awake, staying late all night, and all the arms have no veins left in them and blood dripping off of me, and all this shit is happening. By this time, things are getting really raggedy, you know, and I did not mean to get to this kind of difficulty. I'm getting taken to jail on any given occasion. Everything is going wrong, and by this time, I'd make decisions. I would make a decision that I'm going to straighten up. I said, I'm going to straighten up. I'm going to quit getting loaded. I'm going to really straighten up. I'm not going to get high no more. And I stopped, and about 2 days later, I'd have a seizure. And I'd have this seizure just fall out and everything. And I thought, well, now here's the deal. You can't stop. That's the thing. I could not stop because then I was doomed to have this seizure. So I had to get loaded for years and years and years. I could not stop because every time I'd stop, I'd have a seizure. So there I am running the streets of Los Angeles, ripping and running and doing all these underworld activities. And I remember getting knocked in the head by somebody with a gun and bloodied my eye and have to go. I got stabbed in the lung one night because I hit this friend, my good friend. I hit him in the head with a hammer. 3 times, and over some boys, and so he stabbed me, and I remember this blood was spurting out and everything, and so I was so loaded, that I just got a Band-Aid and put a Band-Aid over it, you know, and took a Tylenol and laid down, and that was what I did. I figured I'd be cool, you know, and I came to and the blood was on the bed. My mother said, what's wrong with you? And they took me to the hospital, and I got to the hospital, and they said, oh, your lung and everything else, and I'm so tore up. You know how when you're staggering, so drunk and loaded, and I'm tore up and everything, and they wouldn't give me any medicine. You know how you get in the hospital and you're hurt and injured and they sew you up. They give you some medicine. They didn't give me nothing. So I was pissed off. They didn't give me no drugs, and they didn't have nothing to drink either. And so I left, you know, I just AMA'd, I just left, and that was the way my life was. It's just always something like that, and I'm coming and going and not knowing what's wrong, and then they, in the 60s, they had started, they thought that the kids, or maybe it was the 70s, that the kids in Los Angeles should go, and so they started a lot of different programs at that time, and they had these drug programs, and they had the free clinic, and you could go to the free clinic, and they'd make you sit in a group, and you sit in a group and talk shit, you know, everything, and then when you get through, they give you a prescription for codeine and Nimbutal. Well, you'd sit in the group too for an hour for some codeine and Nimbutal. And that's the way these programs were. They were kind of dumb. They really didn't know. I think their intentions were good, but they really didn't know. And I started going to all these different programs. I went to programs in Santa Barbara and Ventura, UCLA. I'm on the this and I'm on that program. I got on the methadone maintenance program, and I'm on methadone maintenance because I thought I don't want to shoot heroin no more. And I stayed on that. That stuff sucks your bones out. It's just like it just takes you and takes your soul away from you. And you know it, and it's nothing you can do about it. You just doomed. So all I did was take methadone and drink every day, just trying to make it. By this time, I'm pitiful, you know. And now, you know, my mother and them are looking at me really going, And it's nothing worse than a black woman telling you that. Nothing. Make you feel like a piece of caca, you know. Nothing you could do. Turn your head and keep stepping. So I'm lost now. My brain is gone. I'm trying to make it, and I try different things, and I try to straighten up here, and maybe if I left this alone, and that would be it. And somehow or another, I went into a drug program, and I stayed in that program for 2 years. Now, I'm in that program for 2 years. There was about 20 months, I'll say. And in that program, they taught us about, you know, needles and drugs and our, you know, the self-esteem and the feelings and all this stuff. And we're ready, you know. We're armed with this information. And the day I came out, the night I came out, I was drunk before sundown. Drunk before sundown. I thought, man, so I don't know what to do. I'm just doomed, you know. I have no way to make it. I don't know nothing else. I know something's wrong with me. I remember telling this girl that I knew. I told her, I said, you know, I'm an alcoholic. And she looked at me and said, oh, no, you're not, Don. I thought, she's crazy, you know, because I knew I'm drinking all the time. It's not, you know, when I was a little boy in my neighborhood, they had these men that were in the alley and on the street, and they were winos. And I remember Bowie and Uncle Charlie and Rufus and all them were all out there on the street. They drank wine all the time, and we'd laugh at them. You know, we'd laugh at them and make fun of them and what have you. But, you know, we have to respect them, what they were. Rufus would lay down on the streetcar track, and the streetcar you know, it's on a track. It can't go around it. And he tells him to go around and stuff like that. And we laugh at them people and everything. And here I know, you know, and I don't know what to do. And things are getting worse and worse. I've been doing it for 20-something years. And life has taken on a flavor that's really drastic. And I don't know. I was just doomed. Just doomed. I couldn't hold a job down anymore. I couldn't, you know how you get, you're clever, you can pull these things off and you go and get a job, you know, you can talk good and straighten up for a minute and they'll hire you on the job, you know, and then you get there and mess up really bad, you know. And that's what would happen to me. And I remember going for a job interview one time and I had a briefcase and I can remember it just as good. I went to this job and I was going to get a job as an activities director because I had this little license, this chicken shit license I got. And so I'm there to get this job. And I remember in the briefcase, I had a half pint of rum to get me through, you know, just get me through. And I was insulted that the man didn't hire me. Can you imagine how I smelt? And I thought, this man didn't hire me. And I thought, well, and I went on about my business. And I'm running around with people that were really low life. And I remember one guy telling me that, he said, Donald, you ain't nothing. And he was a tramp. Just a tramp, you know. And he told me that it hurt my heart. You know, I thought, man, how could he do this? And what had happened was my mother and father, what actually happened was that I got into a fight with my father one day and hit him. And that was the straw that broke the camel's back. And they said, you just aren't welcome here, you know. And they got rid of me somehow or another. I was sleeping. I was homeless when it wasn't, you know, popular. But they got rid of me, and they actually moved. They moved, sold their building, and moved away, and didn't tell me where they went, you know. And I was hurt, you know, that they would do me like that, their baby boy, you know. So I didn't know. So I had no place to go, and I just moved down to downtown, which is Skid Row, and I lived downtown in Skid Row, and made it hustling around, trying to, you know, get a drink, and you have to get money together, and I had determined that I wouldn't use any more drugs, that I would just drink. So I just drank Thunderbird wine. That's all I did. It was just Thunderbird and me, and I'm drinking that and trying to make it, and I would think some days, I'm going to straighten up today. I'm not going to drink nothing. I'm not going to drink nothing. And I couldn't go 20 minutes. 20 minutes. I had to get down there and hustle up a bottle somehow or another. And I'm downtown scuffling along. I didn't have no shoes either. And I'm walking around with all raggedy clothes on. I'm a bum and everything. And what happened, my niece saw me downtown doing the same thing that Rufus used to do. You know, that I was downtown directing traffic, you know, telling people, welcome to Los Angeles in my underwear, you know. And so my nephew came down to kind of look out for me. And I was living in those flop houses and trying to make it. And things had come to a really sad situation. I didn't know what to do. I felt bad all the time. And I had done so many things. So much had happened in my life. And I didn't know nothing. And so we had a family picnic in August of 1979, and it was a hot summer day, and I determined that I would go to the picnic and, you know, see everybody in the family, you know, and be part of the thing and eat some chicken, you know, and things. And I got to the picnic. My niece took me to the picnic, and we got there, and I saw a bottle of cold duck, and I went and got the bottle of wine, and I drank that wine, and I'm ready now, baby. I'm getting set, and I smoked me a little joint and everything, and I'm feeling good now. And then the family's going to say the prayer, you know, and my family always says, I told you, we're a Christian family, Baptist at best, you know, and we're all going to say the prayer, and I'm, blah, 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 you blah, blah, and they say, shut up, you know, and everything, and I know they'll knock me out if I don't shut up, so I shut up for a minute, you know, and they said the prayer, and then we had have a theme song every year for our family reunion, and the theme song that year was the Sister Sledge. We are family. That was the theme song for our family. So I thought, well, that's a hip old song, you know, and I'm tore up. You know how you tore up from the floor up, you know, and I'm I'm there, and the music starts, and they're singing, and I, you know, I know all the words to this one. And we are family. Do, 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 do. Hey, I got all my, and I start to taking my clothes off. Because I'm going to show them how good I can dance naked, you know. And they said, oh, no, take your uncle home. Get him out of here, you know. And so they drove me away in my drunken state, that was me. And September the 28th of 1979, and my mother and my aunts and my uncle and my daddy got home, and they said, they got on the phone. I didn't know this. They had me someplace up, and they said, let's pray for Donald. Remember, he had some sense at one time, and maybe if we pray for him, and they believe in prayer. So they all hit a phone prayer line, and they prayed that night. The night of that picnic, they prayed and everything. I don't know nothing about it. I'm trying to make it, you know, trying to give me a taste, you know. And so that night, we were at this hotel, and I remember we got in trouble because we just got in trouble again and broke all the stuff up. And the police came, and there were about 8 of them with guns drawn. And by this time, I didn't walk around. I crawled around most of the time while I was around the place because I couldn't stand up. My equilibrium was really bad. And I always thought people were pushing me down, you know. So they came, and I remember they had the guns drawn, and I was on the floor. And I remember looking up at them thinking, shoot me. Just shoot me, you know. And naturally, they didn't. They just, you know, and went away and make you feel really bad. You're not worth shooting, you know. And so I didn't, that night went by, and the next day, something hit me that maybe I should ask somebody to help me, you know, or something. And I just thought, okay, so I went to the yellow pages, and I tore the page out that said alcohol on it. And I checked it out, and I figured it out. I'm trying to figure out what to do. And I picked a place that was on 5th Street because 5 was between 4 and 6. That was how my brain worked, you know. And so I got it, and I had to somehow or another figure out how to get some money so I could make a phone call. So, you know, this is either you can get some wine or you're going to get a dime, you know. And so I got a dime somewhere, and I called up this place, and this lady answered the phone, and I asked her if she could help me, and she said, can you get down here? And I said, yeah, I'll get down there. And I was at another location in L.A., another sort of sorted part of town, and I couldn't get there because the buses were on strike. There was no way I could walk there because I didn't have that much strength. I couldn't make it. I was still shaking. I shook all the time. And some guy from El Salvador was eating a pupusa, and I asked him if he'd give me a ride down there. And he said, sure, as soon as he got through. He got finished, and he gave me a ride down to 5th Street and dropped me off in front of this place. And I just went on in, and there was these bums there, you know, on the sidewalk. They're there, and you just cross over them. And I'm a bum, too. I had some torn Levi's on, and I didn't have any shoes. I had a red T-shirt and a jacket that I'd stolen from somebody and a suitcase full of junk. I mean, really junk. And I thought it was valuable. You know how you're stupid, you know. And I get in this place, and I go sit down in the couches that were there, and I just sat there. And a lady came out, and she said, you're the one that called, huh? And I thought, yeah. And she said, come here. And she was kind of a rough-looking woman, you know, and I went with her, and she sat me down in a chair, and she said, are you serious about doing something about this problem? And I told her, yes, lady, I'm serious as a heart attack, you know. I'm beaten bad. I mean, I really was beaten bad. I didn't tell her that, but I guess I really look bad, you know. And she said, well, do you have a gay problem? I thought, oh, shit, you know, yeah, damn, you know, that's the, you know what, lady, I said, I'm gay, but that's not the problem. I said, it's this wine that's killing me. And she said, I know it. And I looked at her, she knew it. And she said, honey, the reason I asked you is there's a place in Los Angeles that's opened up and has a good reputation for helping people like you. And I said, really? She said, yeah. She said, tomorrow when they ask you where you want to be dispatched to, you tell them you want to go to the Van Ness Recovery House. And so I said, okay. And she gave me a towel and some Bugler tobacco, roll your own, and gave me a bed and put me out on this bed. And I'll never forget, it was a hot, hot day, and the winos were outside at the door over there, and I could see them over there clinking their bottles and everything. You know, you can always get a taste from a wino. I didn't move. I stayed right in that bed. I went and took a shower. I hadn't taken one for some time because I was afraid of water, because water scared me. And I felt like I was going to be washed down the drain. You know how it goes down the drain like that? You know, you feel like you're going to go down, you know. And so, anyway, she went away. My nephew showed up there, and he said, "Uncle Donald, come on. I got a place you could go to. Come on, I got to find a place." I said, "No, nephew, I'm going to stay here." And I stayed there. And the next day, they were issuing us out and sending us places, and I got in the line with the rest of the bums, and I got up there, and it was my turn, and this man was right there, this black man, and he said, "Where do you want to go?" And I said, I couldn't remember. I couldn't remember the name of it, nothing in the world. And I said, "Well, the gay recovery house." And he went, like I slapped him or something, you know? I thought, you know, I'm not no trouble. I'm weak as water, you know. And so, anyway, a lady swooped around him. She heard it, and she swooped around him, and she said, "I'll take care of him." And she had red hair, and her name was Sally, and she made the phone call for me to the Van Ness house, and she talked to them on the phone and said, okay, all right. Yes, okay. She said, "They'll take you tomorrow. They're going to ship you out." And I told her, "Thank you. I've never seen her ever again. Ever again. Never saw her. Angel." The next day, I get shipped on up there, and this guy is taking me out. He was scared, too. He was just a Chicano dude. He was leery because I'm gay. You know, he's got to deliver me to this gay place. I could see it. You know, I'm, you know, police, you know. He looked like shit anyway, you know. Isn't it funny how guys that look like shit think we want them? It drives you crazy. Yeah. So anyway, he got me to the place and dropped me off, and I walked up the walk and got in the place, and this guy was there, and he had a muumuu on, and he gave me some cigarettes, and he said, "Come here," and sat me down and asked me a couple of questions. And he said to me, "What do you know about Alcoholics Anonymous?" And I said, "Nothing." I was 43 years old in one of the biggest cities in this world with Alcoholics Anonymous meetings everywhere, and I didn't know nothing about it, nothing. And so I thought, he got up and left the room. And I thought, shit, you should have said you knew something, you know? He came back in the room, and he said to me, "What are you willing to do?" And I told him on August the 29th of 1979, anything. And I meant that with my whole heart. I was so tired. I was so beat. Just anything. And he said, "Well," he said, "we read the big book around here, and there's a copy of it in the bookcase over there, and we're going to take you in the house." And I thought, okay, a little flicker, just a flicker, maybe something here. I went and got the big book that hot summer day, and I took it to the front porch. Check this out. This is my first day, my very first day, and I took Miss Big Book and read her. It was a song to my heart. I could not believe what this book is saying. It's telling me everything about me. Can you imagine? I'm wounded. 27 years of insanity. And it tells me there is a solution. Thank God. I'm so happy to read this book. And then, you know, when you go on and after you read There's a Solution, it tells you more about alcoholism. And that was a hard one. That was a hard one because it was a little confusing. I don't know what they're trying to say here. All I know is it's something very important. Very important. You could fuck up easily. Fuck up. reading this book, and I'm thinking, man, and you know, it tells you, and then you go on into the next chapter to the agnostic, you know, we agnostics in there, and it says exactly what this book is all about, is to get you to get a power that will help you overcome this problem. I'll be. And I thought, well, I didn't have no trouble. I'm a fine little Baptist boy. I never was mad at God. I was just busy doing what I wanted to do. I had always done just what I wanted to do, and that's how I got in trouble. Doing exactly what I wanted to do, when I wanted to do it, and tell everybody they could kiss my ass. Well, now I'm reading this, and says, oh, well, it's going to be a change here, you know? I'm beating so bad, they got my attention. I don't care. Yeah, I'm ready. And then I read that, the next chapter, and then I went to How It Works. And in How It Works, man, it's serious. I mean, a new person, the first day, can you imagine reading that? Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I'm thinking, boy, you better find out the path quick. You better get this fast. And I'm thinking, oh, man, and it goes on. It tells you about selfishness and self-centeredness. That's the root of our trouble. And it goes on. It says about resentments that have got you in trouble. And this conduct about sex is to be questioned, too. And you are full of fear now. Woo-wee. And I'm reading this, and I didn't have any of my glasses that I had were from Thrifty. You know, those Thrifty glasses, you know, I didn't have any hooks on. So I had to read the book upside down like that. And I'm reading this book, and I remember finishing chapter 5, and I closed that book. I thought, oh, man. And I thought to myself, I wonder if I'll be able to do it. I wonder if I'll be able to do it. And my next thought was, you got to, Donald. This is everything. You got to do it. Man, I put my whole heart and soul into working this program. Everything they told me to do, I did it. I didn't get in any trouble. I didn't call into question anything. If I had a question about something, I kept it to myself. I just shut up. For once, can you imagine shutting up for once in your life? You know, I wouldn't say nothing. And they tell me, you got to go to meetings all the time. I said, okay. I went to meetings all the time. They said, you have to get a job. And I went and got a job. I got a job working in a convalescent hospital cleaning old people's behinds for $3.15 an hour. And I was glad to have a job. And I did that. And people in AA, let me tell you about the people in AA. They started being so nice to me. People would, you know, I moved out of the house and people came over. I remember this queen took me to the secondhand store, you know, the thrift shop, and bought me pancake turners and potholders and cups, and people gave me sheets, and somebody else bought me a TV, a black and white TV, and put a big bold ribbon on it so I'd have a TV. And this girl came along, and she had gone through the Vanessa house, and she slipped some money into my pocket and patted my ass, said, you do that when you get some. And patted my ass. I like that. And I started going to meetings all the time, and I can remember one of the best things I remember, I always like to tell this, is that I didn't have any shoes, you know. And by this time, you know, when you're drunk, you don't care if you don't have any shoes. Who cares if you have any shoes or if you got raggedy clothes? But by this time, everybody at the meeting has shoes, and they're all sitting around looking cute and what have you. And I didn't have any shoes, and my toes look kind of shaky and everything. And I'm trying to hide my feet, and I'm at the meeting. I wish, and they had a boutique, they called it, and people donated clothes to the Van Ness house, and I have real big feet, and nobody had ever donated some shoes that fit me. So I'm just there thinking, oh, I wish I had some shoes. I feel really bad, and I'm real shaky. I remember going to my first meeting, and the woman said, oh, you go home and get you some orange juice and some sweet germ and honey, and you mix it together, and it'll be like taking a Valium. I like that. We'll take a Valium. So I did that, but this, I was sitting there feeling really bad, and a lady came across the room, and she had dark hair, and she had blush on, a little light lipstick, and some cute little Mary Jane slippers on, and a cute dress, you know, and it looked really nice. And she walked all the way across the room, and she came all the way over to me and said, "Hi, my name's Michelle. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous." Man, you can't beat that. You can't beat that when you feel like a piece of shit. You know, people wanted me so bad to get sober. I also was not. There weren't very many black people, Penny, either, when I got there. There just weren't a lot. And the people that were there had to make up for it. And they did it. They did it. They were so kind to me. They were nice to me. They wanted me to get sober. They gave me sponsorship. They did everything. You know, they made sure that that I understood that they wanted me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I read the big book, too. And in the big book, it had a story in there about this woman who was called the Belle of the Bar, and she thought she was fine, and she looked like shit. And and she shot heroin. In fact, she shot 16 caps of heroin on a daily basis. I thought, woo-wee, that's a lot of smack to shoot, you know? They put her story in the big book for a reason. You know, they had a story in there about Jim, who was the first black man in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they called him a Negro. Well, by the time I was in AA, we were no longer Negroes. Right? This time, I think we were African Americans. And so, but I knew what they were trying to do. I did not take issue with that. I knew they were welcoming me into Alcoholics Anonymous. And so this is how I got in. People were so nice. They made me want to be in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was so happy. I was gung-ho. I started right away. By the time I was 5 months sober, they'd given me a baby. Some old ding-a-ling, crackhead, crystal freak child, you know? And he's still sober today. Still sober today, you know? I started working the steps of recovery right away. I started doing them as soon as possible because I knew. I mean, it's like, I knew you got to do this now. You can't fool around. You will be messed up. Look where you were. You were down in Skid Row scuffing around, having seizures, getting stabbed and everything else like that. And they told you if you drink again, it's going to be just where you left off, if not worse. I thought, worse? Shit, that's the cemetery, you know? So I started doing that and trying to make it and doing the steps of recovery, and I did them the best I could. I tried so hard, and people started telling me about jobs in AA, and a friend of mine told me there was a job for me up in West Hollywood. This guy he made lamps and everything, very fabulous. Queen, she made these fabulous lamps and everything. And he wanted to hire somebody to do the office work, and I got that job, and I did that for a while, and he paid me a little bit more money, and then somebody else came along and said, "There's a job for you in the field of recovery. Didn't you do something like that before?" And I said, "Well, down in Orange County when I was shooting heroin and everything." And so they got me a job, and I heard people talk about going to school. You know, I hear people like June and people that went to school and everything. Maybe I could go to school. You know, maybe I could do that. So I got another friend of mine, gave me another job, which was at nighttime, so I could go to school. I went to school and got a degree in psychology and everything, and got me a good job. And I was able to get me a car. I got me a car, and let me tell you about the shoes I have bought. I got shoes, Melody. Enough shoes for everybody, you know. But my life has opened up so nice, so wonderful. I worked for a long time and did that, and then I retired under duress. They actually terminated me. I thought, well, they did because I was old, but they said I did something. But anyway, I got terminated from this job last year. Boom, just like that. Bam. Oh, I'm wrecked. And I thought, no. Don't worry, because something's going to happen. Well, lo and behold, I'm 62. And at 62, you can go to the Social Security Department and tell them that you're 62, and they squeeze it. Honey, you'll get a check for the rest of your life on such and such a date, and that's it. Don't worry. I got a check coming forever and ever. And then... And we live a long time in my family. So now I'm free of doing whatever. I got about 10 more babies and everything, and life is going on pretty cool, and things have happened. So I thought, there's this new place in Hollywood called the Gay and Lesbian Village. It is fabulous. If any of you are ever there, please come in and see me. I am the greeter. I go there to see it, just to look at it, because this is a new gay thing. Go check it out, you know. So I go in there, and there's this friend of mine on the program, and I tell her, well, yeah, you know, I'm retired, and, you know, but later on, I'm going to get a little part-time job. And she said, hold everything. And she said, Jackie, and Jackie's on the program, too, and said, come here. They hired me on the spot to work at this job, greeting people like I do in AA. Hi, come on in. Hi. And they and they pay me cash money for nothing. Anyway, this is the best thing in the world. And you know what's so funny about it is you can make a certain amount of money over your Social Security check, but you can only make a certain amount. Exactly the amount that I make is how much you can give. It's just too much. I thought, man, and I'm free. I'm free to come and go. It's the best thing that ever happened to me. Now, my mother thinks I'm it. My mother thinks I'm it. She sold her house. She put all her money in my name. Can you believe it? She's the one that moved away. I'm in charge of all her business and what have you. I got nieces and nephews that are, I love them. I just love them. I'm Uncle Donald. I'm Uncle Donald. They love to see Uncle Donald coming. And I love to, I take them to the beach. We go and eat hot dogs. And what, can we come to your house, Uncle Donald? And I remember when their mothers and fathers saw me bleeding and jumping out of ceilings and helicopters overhead and all that stuff. And these kids will never have to see their uncle do that as long as I keep doing what I'm doing. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I go to meetings all the time. I go to meetings everywhere. And when I get a chance to come here, I'm on this fixed income. They say, would you come to Dallas, Texas? And I go, yeah, honey, I'll come. You know, it's the best thing in the world to be able to come down here and tell you what God has done for me in the time I've been here. I am 19 years clean and sober through the grace of God and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is August the 29th of 1979. And that's what I came down here to tell you all, that God is wonderful. He loves me. I am his most fabulous child. And he loves me. And you know, as much as he loves me, he loves you all too. And thank you for letting me come down here.